Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true.
All right. Good afternoon, folks. Finally, and welcome back. This is Mark Call. We got the regular crew here for the Torah Teachers Roundtable, and we are anxious to pick things back up again. There was a problem with the automation on the station last week, and basically that's what happens when, if you've been hearing the ads, we have a station engineer who has finally and rightfully retired, so blessings to Phil and whatever he pursues at this point, but it left us in the lurch, and as of last week, the automation messed up and it was playing music, so we couldn't talk over it. And as a result, we did not do a show. We are hopefully live today. We still had a problem, as probably if you were listening, you noticed at the top of the hour. And I'll have to figure out what to do about the replay. It may end up just being a little bit short. But nevertheless, we are finally live, and this is a good thing. And we're also talking about the Torah Teachers Roundtable show. We got Ken Irvin and Mark Patron online with me as, well, I would say as usual, but at least as we're supposed to. And we're working our way through the book of Ezekiel, almost finished at this point, chapter 36. We touched on it last time, but what we're going to do this today is just start over and read the first few verses again. And I'm hoping everybody's here. So what I'm going to do is I'll read the first couple of verses, and then we'll go over, let's see, I'll just pick randomly. We'll go to Ken first. And it says this, "And you, son of man, prophesy to the mountains of Israel and say, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahuwah. Thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, because the enemy has said of you, aha, the ancient heights have become your possession. Therefore prophesy and say, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, because they made you desolate and swallowed you up on every side, so that you became the possession of the rest of the Goyim, the nations, and you are taken up by the lips of talkers and slandered by the people. Therefore, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahuwah Eloheka. Thus says Yahuwah Eloheka to the mountains, the hills, the rivers, the valleys, the desolate wastes, and the cities that have been forsaken, which became plunder and mockery to the rest of the nations all around. Therefore, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, surely I have spoken in my burning jealousy against the rest of the nations and against all Edom, who gave my land to themselves as a possession, with wholehearted joy and spiteful minds in order to plunder its open country." So we'll pause there because the next word, of course, is therefore. And we'll talk about those first few verses again, going first to Ken. So, he says go to MP. All right. Mark, are you ready? Let's go to you then. And howdy.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome back to TTRT, all you guys out there in Radio Land. We did have a lot of fun last week trying to get this thing going, but we're actually here today. So here we go. Yehezkel chapter 36, Zamra's opening comment on chapter 36. This is a regular Jewish site. These guys have a real handle on the Torah and the prophets, and so I love to quote them. They're very, very good. Anyway, here's what it says on verse 1. It says, "And you, son of man, prophesy to the mountains of Israel." That's verse 1. Now, after speaking of the retribution against Mount Seir, he now speaks consolation to the mountains of Israel. That according to Radak. Today's Edomites, scattered across the whole world, show not the least interest in their ancestral territories in the Rocky Mountains of Seir in southern Jordan. But for 2,000 years, Jews have thought about their land and mentioned it in their prayers many times every day, and not one of them has the least doubt that their country is the same mountainous strip of land that everyone in the world knows as Israel. Now, that's the end of Zamra on verses 1 to 4, and here's me. In Hebrew, the opening is Ve'ata ben Adam, okay, and for you, son of Adam. So don't remind ourselves, let's remind ourselves what Yah said from the whole of chapter 35. Yah's judgment of Mount Seir, the eastern bank of the Rift Valley between the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba, which is where Yah allowed the Egyptian cavalry to follow on the same dry that Israel had walked across on, if you remember crossing the Red Sea, until he didn't anymore. He brought this Red Sea down on them. Okay, so Yah said, when the whole earth rejoices, I will make you desolate as when you rejoiced at the desolation of Yehuda Israel. That's what he said to Egypt. Okay, and that's what he's saying to the Philistines at this point. The Ishmaelites of Mount Seir had taken advantage of Yehuda's exile to Babylon and subjugated the inhabitants as they had before Israel's return from exile in Egypt. That is not to say that Yehuda had not ruled the area with a strong hand, but while they did rule over the native people, they did not enslave them as Mount Seir's Ishmaelites had before Israel's return from Mitzrayim. Israel wanted to live in their native lands in peace with the new arrivals. How those newcomers reacted to Israel upon their return home would have a major impact on their treatment. In retrospect, I have to think that had the squatters on Israel's land, which is exactly what they were, lived on more or less harmony with Israel, they'd have found that their lives would have been infinitely better than before Israel's return under the Ishmaelite regime that Israel overpowered, thanks to the interposition of Yah. Now, even without cooperation with Israel, they had a better life than under the Ishmaelites. Now, Zamra has this comment to verses 2-4. And other nations have always wanted unjustly to take the promised inheritance of Israel, children of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, for themselves. Because the enemy has said against you, aha, the eternal high places are an inheritance for us, in verse 2, the mountains of Israel are called Bamos Olam, the high places of the world, because the land of Israel is higher than all the other lands, according to Radak. Now, that doesn't mean that they are physically higher, but is the highest spiritual place on earth, spiritually the highest place on earth. These high places are on the lips of the talkers and the gossip of the people, according to verse 3. Never has this been more apparent than today, when Israel is in the talk, is the talk of the whole world, in the United Nations, in the world media, and etc. Every day, the Palestinians and their backers, most notably President Ahmadinejad in Iran, declare that Israel must be wiped off the map, and the land snatched from its rightful owners. Now, Zamra kind of dates itself in that comment. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has not been president of Iran since 2013. So this particular commentary is at least 10 years old. But in the meanwhile, the basic idea is the same today as it was then. And I'm done with chapter 4, or verse 4 rather. If someone would like to take the mic, I'd be more than happy to give it up.
Okay, Ken, you got some comments you want to make on that?
No, I think I finished up through verse 4 last time around. So if we can at least, let's say, read up to about 8, I can continue.
Well, that's what they're
there
for, so let's begin there.
9? Okay.
And we finish with the end of the introduction of the prophecy. Therefore, says Yahuwah, prophecy and say concerning the land of Israel, and say to the mountains, the hills, the rivers, and the valleys, thus says Yahuwah Elohecha, because I have spoken in my zeal and my fury, because you have borne the shame of the nations, therefore, thus says Yahuwah Elohecha, I have raised my hand in an oath that surely the nations that are around you shall bear their own shame. But you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and yield your fruit to my people, Israel, for they are about to come. For indeed I am for you, and I will turn to you, and you shall be tilled and sown. And let's pause there. That's kind of in the middle of the prophecy.
Okay. Yeah, hello everybody, and welcome back, by the way. I think we missed you guys as much as you missed us. But
maybe anyway. Maybe more, because I don't think you missed us all that much. but go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I believe the joy of the heart for those in the land that were not Yisroel was what caused Yah such fire in verse 5 and fury in verse 6. And, of course, we see Yah's jealousy mentioned in both verses 5 and 6. And though this would most assuredly show him disrespect when they desire and are quite pleased in separating Yisrael from Yah's land, knowing, and of course they knew this, knowing that this would be breaking apart what Yah desired to join together. Of course, Yah has been, you know, joining his people to his land for quite some time up until this point. And of course, on occasion, they've been spit out due to their sin. And this, you know, again and again, though, we see that Edom and others have been taking advantage of this. This is what really, I think, fired Yah up. Now, I believe both fire and fury would also indicate judgment, but most definitely with negative results. This judgment was for those heathen left in the land, as it says here, as well as all of Edom, all of which brought shame and destruction to Yah's land. Now, on another note, I have to share a fascination that I had noted in these few verses, beginning in verse 6 and through verse 8. We see the Hebrew word nasa, that's Strong's number H5375, mentioned four different times with four different definitions. I kind of like that because it really gives us not only variation, but it also gives you or may help show you the similarities in those variations, so that when you see one variation, you may think, hopefully, of the other variations, because sometimes we're sort of led down the wrong variational path, if you know what I mean, when you're reading from different translations. So the first occurrence is in verse 6, which states, Behold, I have spoken in my jealousy and in my fury, because ye have borne the shame of the heathen. Now, don't think I just read the word born as in the past tense of to birth. Instead, this word ends in an E in the English, yes. And thus it's the past tense word for to bear. And by the way, am I still being heard okay?
Yeah, we had an echo for a second, but it's gone.
Okay.
Yeah, you're coming through fine.
Okay, good.
And yeah, born does mean to have born something.
Carry it upon your shoulders.
Yeah, like a past tense. Right. So, let's see, where was I at here? Thus, they did bear the shame of the heathen. Okay? The second and third instances are in the next verse, even in a single sentence where it's written, now this is verse 7, therefore thus saith Yahuwah Elohim, I have lifted up my hand. Surely the heathen that are about you, they shall bear their shame. The English words lifted up is this word nasa, which is probably, at least in my thought, the most basic form of the word, as in to elevate, okay, to lift up or elevate. And in the same sentence, the word bear is this word nasa also, meaning to carry a burden. But in this case, so that it's lifted up for all eyes to see. If you're looking or considering how these different variations of the word are connected, okay, and can thus see the likening even in our English words. And lastly, we see the English word yield, which is, again, this Hebrew word, nasa. Thus, the mountains will yield their fruit for Yisrael to consume. In this case, it's bringing the fruit forth or
Absolutely.
Before their eyes. Go ahead, MP.
Yeah, I'm just agreeing. That's exactly what that's doing. What they're doing is they're bearing the fruit to each other.
Right, yes. Bringing it and bringing it before their eyes even so that they may consume it.
Exactly.
So thus the mountains will yield their fruit for Yisrael to consume. In this case, it's bringing the fruit forth or before their eyes, yet another form of lifting up. So though Yah made this word for multiple purposes, hopefully we can see that all purposes are clearly related and understood to be variations of the same. So well done, Mr. Creator of all things. I have to give him a big pat on the back for helping me and maybe others understand this word, Nasah. Now, verse 8 is a pleasant relief of negativity towards the land, to where the land will again be the location or home for his people. They are coming as he prophesies. And verse 9 is even more wondrous details of the land. Yah is bringing much back with this reunion, okay? The land being tilled, that's the word abad in the Hebrew, Strong's number 8547. This brings us, this word abad, at least with me, it brings us back to both the garden in Bereshit or Genesis 2 verse 5, where it's written, and every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew. For Yahuwah Elohim had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was not a man to till the ground. And immediately leaving the garden, we see in Bereshit or Genesis 3 verse 23, it's written, therefore, Yahuwah Elohim sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence it was taken. We can see in these early iterations that man was needed to till the ground. And he actually came from it. Remember?
That's right. He's,
yeah. I mean, his name is Adam, which really is from the earth.
Right.
And thus he is most certainly entwined in the action. So we also see that the word sown, the word zarah in the Hebrew, Strong's number 2232, brings us back to the beginning as well. Note the words yielding and bearing from Bereshit chapter 1 verse 11, where it's written, and Yah said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so. And here in Bereshit 1 verse 29, and Yahuwah said, or actually Elohim said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat. So both a tree yielding fruit and an herb bearing seed would be metaphors throughout Scripture depicting such things as righteous men, which would yield good fruit and bear good seed. Thus Yah is truly blessing the land and prophesying such goodness upon it in these verses, as well as bringing both Yisrael and the land back to the ways in the beginning. That's what I love about these few verses from 5 through 9, is that it really brings us back to the beginning and helps us better understand such metaphors. So anyway, that's what I have up through verse 9. So I'll go ahead and stop here and let MP catch up a little bit.
All right. We're going to keep moving? Okay. Here we go. Verses 5 through 9. Remember that Edomia equals Edom, okay, which is another name for Esav, Yaakov's wicked twin brother. I think a maternal twin, two ova, individually fertilized. Way to go, Yitzhak. Yah has pronounced judgment against all of Israel's neighbors who have sought Israel's and Yehuda's destruction. He started with Edom, which is Israel Yehuda's main enemy, beginning with the jealousy that came from the twin brothers striving in Rivka's womb. In Genesis chapter 25, verses 20 to 26, we get this. And Yitzhak was 40 years old when he took Rivka to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. And Yitzhak entreated Yah for his wife because she was barren. And Yah was entreated of him, and Rivka, his wife, conceived, and the children struggled within her. And she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of Yah. And Yah said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like an hairy garment, and they called his name Esav," which means red. "And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esav's heel, and his name was called Yaakov, and Yitzhak was 33 years old when she bare them."
And with that, folks, apologies and a quick explanation here, because this segment's going to be a bit short. What happened is we had some more problems with the automation at the station. We're thankful at least we're going to have a new engineer online soon, and hopefully things will get better. In the meanwhile, I'm editing this, and there's not much I can do to fill in the 2 minutes that were lost, because we thought the music should have come up, and it didn't. But in any case, I'm going to put the music in now. So stay with us. We'll be right back for the second segment, as edited, in just a minute.
You better wake up before it's too late. Get ready to rumble. Put all the God's armor on. We're killing our babies before they are born. Stand up and be kind and come and sound the alarm. Are you one of God's children or nothing but the devil's
Good afternoon, folks. Welcome back. This should be the second segment of the Torah Teachers Roundtable, and I'll check my watch and make sure the clock is about right and all that kind of jazz. We've had some technical issues last week and this week both, but we're trying to get back on schedule, and unfortunately the computer automation isn't with us, so what we're going to do is just continue on. So, MP, we interrupted you somewhere around the bottom of the hour. Why don't you go ahead and pick it up where you were?
All right, I will do that. I had just commented on verse 5, and I'm going to start over. The end of verse 5 leaves me with the impression that Edom just wanted the land because it had been promised to Yaakov, and for that reason, Edom would do his very best to destroy it. The strife between Israel and Edom is since the brothers were in the womb. Ain't nobody going to make that rivalry stop until Yah Yeshua's kingdom in the new heavens. Here's a Zamra. They say measure for measure. God swears that he will judge all of the residue of the nations and Edom with the fire of his jealousy, because they have appointed my land to themselves for a possession, with the joy of all their heart, with disdainful minds, to cast it out for prey. Okay, did you get that? Edom, Esav, only wants the land with the purpose of destroying it because it is Israel's and Yah's, not theirs. If it were theirs, they would end up destroying it anyway, but not with the same kind of relish. Edom, Esav love to defile what is Israel's and Yah's. Zamra probably hates to destroy Edom's plans, but here's their input on verses 7 and 8.
Hey, quickly, Mempi, sorry, let me interrupt just for a second, because I hadn't
Please,
heard
go
you
ahead.
Talk about this before. If that is true, it sounds like what you're suggesting, and at least I'm suggesting what you're implying is, that it is Edom that is running the United States, because we have the same attitude here. Let's destroy this land. Let's destroy this nation. Let's destroy from sea to shining sea the Purple Mountains' majesty and the hills of rolling grain and you name it, anything else in between. I can't help but think at least we're talking about a similar spirit.
Absolutely. We have an Edomite spirit in the government of our country, and it's one of the reasons that we are going into the dumper so quickly. Okay? They want to destroy this country. They want for us to go into bondage. That's just how it is. That's how I see it. And I don't think anybody's ever going to ever tell me different. Anyway, let me move on with what I was about to say.
MP, can I add one quick thing?
Please, go ahead.
Just a quick thing, because MC mentioned this too, and I can't help but see all these parallels, is that of course, at the same time, we see those who are in control, and of course, they're doing this secretly. You see them literally destroying things, as in they're burning up institutions, they're burning up factories, they're bringing down places where our food is processed. You know, all this stuff is being destroyed. They're spilling serious waste all over the land that gets into water supplies, etc. I mean, you can see all this terrible destruction going on. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, they crashed that train in East Palestine a couple of 3 months ago. Purposely, they did that. They did it purposely. And that thing contaminated the Ohio River from that point all the way to the Mississippi, and from there all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. The water was destroyed for easily 3,500 miles.
Absolutely.
And
you know, we don't even know how many people have been hurt by this.
Yeah.
I mean, because they hush it, you know?
Exactly. You know, it was a big news
it's
for 2 weeks, and
news.
Then it's gone. But it's still going on.
Right.
Anyway, let me get back to my notes.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to go back to the beginning of the last sentence. Zamra probably hates to destroy Edom's plans, but here's their input on verses 7 and 8. Things will turn out the very opposite of what Israel's enemies imagine. Surely the nations that are about you shall bear their own shame, in verse 7. As when the Arab armies that vowed the destruction of Israel in 1948, 1967, and 1973 were roundly defeated. On the contrary, you, O mountains of Israel, shall shoot forth your branches and yield your fruit to my people of Israel, for they will soon be coming, in verse 8. When the land of Israel will give forth its fruits generously, that is when the end will be close. For throughout the Bible, you have no more clearly revealed end than in this verse, according to Sanhedrin 98a. The last century has witnessed the miraculous revival of agriculture in Israel after 2,000 years of desolation. Okay, and that is not because Yah loves Israel more than he does Edom, but because Israel loves Yah more than Edom loves Yah. Edom has turned away from their father Yitzhak's Yah and turned to any god that it can discover, whether Baal or Allah, which are actually one and the same, only the names have been changed to make the guilty feel better. That's what I got through verse 8.
Okay.
Oh, verse 9, I'm sorry.
Are we ready to read on, guys?
Okay, we'll have to read on a little bit further.
All right, let's continue. See, we were at about verse 9 or 10.
Yeah.
For indeed I am for you.
Yeah,
I will turn to you. You shall be filled and you shall be tilled and sown. So he is now referring to the land directly and says, I will multiply men upon you, all the house of Israel, all of it, and the cities shall be inhabited and the ruins rebuilt. I will multiply you upon man I will multiply upon you, man and beast, and they shall increase and bear young. I'll make you inhabited as in former times, and do better for you than at your beginnings. Then you shall know, here it is again, Ki Ani Yahuwah. Yes, I will cause men to walk Amen. On you, my people Israel. They shall take possession of you, and you shall be their inheritance. No more shall you bereave them of children. Or just bereave them is what the Hebrew says, but of children is the context that's added in by the translators in English. Thus says Yahuwah Elohecha, because they say to you, you devour men and bereave your nation, therefore you shall devour men no more, nor bereave your nation any more, says Yahuwah Elohecha, nor will I let you hear the taunts of the Goyim, the nations, any more, nor bear the reproach of the peoples any more, nor shall you cause your nation to stumble any more, says Yahuwah Elohecha. So let's pause there. Shall we go to you this time first, Ken?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay by me.
Go ahead, MP, if you
No, like it's
you.
Okay by me. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll let me hit 10 and 11 here. Cuz this is interesting when you see the idea of Yah wanting to multiply men again. I mean, this again brings us back to the beginning. it's funny how we're going back to the beginning a lot here. But yeah, these two verses, 10 and 11, bring back even more vivid and wondrous blessings, in that good souls, both man and beast even, will flourish and bear good fruit in the land. And such good souls will repair the waste places and cities, and bring better results than back in the beginning, it says. Which, that's pretty amazing. Other than the fact that I remember from in the beginning, you know, everything was going great in the garden until there was a little slip, you know, and then they were booted out. So, it wasn't that grand for too long, but just for a little while, I suppose. And Yah is once again multiplying men, which is always a good time, a time of growth, and not only good men, but more apparent or lifted up ways in Yah. I remember that from this TV show I've been watching a little bit of. Trying to remember what show that is, but my wife got addicted to it. I think that there's only one more season of it. Do y'all remember what show that was?
I'm not sure what you're referring
to.
The
one where the ladies like to say praise be a lot. Doesn't ring a bell? Anyway.
No, doesn't ring a bell with me.
Okay.
I haven't watched a whole lot of TV for the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
Except reruns on Netflix.
Oh, there you go. The oldies, right? Oldies yeah. But goodie. But yeah, I love to see that Yah is going to multiply men again, it says. Isn't that interesting? Now, does that mean that there will be birthing going on? Because at the moment, it sure doesn't seem like we're in that day. Because in this day, we're definitely being taken away from multiplying. You know, we're being injected with a formula that literally attacks the reproductive system. You know, it homes right, and it actually helps to prevent reproduction. And that may be something that we're going to see a lot of here in the very near future. Not only will many people be dying from what's been put in them, but I believe we're really going to lose a lot of the birth rate that we've had for, you know, thousands of years, literally.
Well, you can absolutely believe that. That's what our scientists are working on. They call themselves scientists. They're not scientists. They're destroyers.
Eugenics.
Yeah, exactly. So,
all the way back to Genesis. Absolutely.
No, eugenics.
Yeah, so it's kind of. Oh, go ahead.
They are eugenicists. They are the kind of people who engineer killing and destroying, and they love it.
Absolutely, yes. They're being Edomites, as MP mentioned a little earlier. Most definitely. They're getting back at the good guys. But yeah, I'm very fascinated to see here that Yah is prophesying that he will multiply men. And I can only hope that that really has to do with making men righteous, okay, multiplying in that way, meaning turning them around, making them clean. And actually, we're going to see that here in the verses coming up. Verses 12 to 15, here we have even more proof of an end-time event. Here we have Israel truly and finally inheriting the land, as Yah had promised thousands of years earlier to Abraham and his descendants. These promises, well, not thousands before this point, but I'm thinking from my day right here, you know, going back dozens of years. And this is prophecy, so this is to come, you know. These promises speak of an eternal end to the bereavement of the nation. The word for bereave is the word, the Hebrew word shakol, Strong's number 7921. It can appropriately be defined as miscarriage or suffer an abortion. And it was as if the land was spitting out the wicked from its womb. But this will be no more, meaning this is eternal, what's about to happen here. His people will inhabit the land forever. Never again will there be word of heathen in this land. But getting back to this word in the Hebrew, shakol, being defined with as miscarriage and suffering an abortion, boy, do we not see that in this day, okay? We see this a lot. As a matter of fact, for those who were kind enough to read through what the Pharmakia provided to us in terms of thousands of pages, you know, a lot of people have gone through this, and they've, you know, brought forth the witnessing when they were testing these so-called vaccines, which nowadays is just such a terrible word for it, but when they were testing it, they were literally bringing on these abortions. They were they became rampant, actually, when you look at how many of the ladies were pregnant and the great percentage of those who miscarried, you know, lost their babies
and became sterile.
This stuff was totally
never were able to conceive.
I'm sorry, go ahead, MC. I didn't hear you, MC. What was that you were saying?
And afterwards, many of them became sterile and never conceived anymore again. And they still don't necessarily know how many people are already sterile and won't ever be able to bear children after that.
Yep. It's the snake virus.
That's what I meant earlier about.
Yeah,
you're right, MP. I've heard that too from certain doctors. This is actually venom. That they're also inserting into us is snake venom.
They combined two very, very potent venoms.
Yes.
And created the COVID-19 Fauci creation.
Right. And yes, it's been so-called proven. I've heard this from a number of doctors now. They've been doing studies around the world. Especially if you look for these studies, you'll see what they're finding out, you know, that yes, this stuff is literally does attack the reproductive areas within the body. So it's no wonder that even though you might, you know, these women may have lost their babies, most likely they're never going to have babies ever again anyway, as MC was pointing out.
Exactly.
So,
it's terrible.
Right. Absolutely. Anyway, yeah, that's what I have up to verse 15. I'll go ahead.
All right. Let me jump on that, too. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left here. Verses 10 to it's going to cover the same stuff, but probably from a different perspective. In verse 10, Yah promises Israel that he will multiply their numbers. He isn't going to add a few, but multiply Israel Yehuda. And I do believe that this multiplication includes all followers of Yah, whether Christian, Messi, or Israel Yehuda. We are seeking his heart to be to be his own. We might even accept a repentant Jehovah's Witness. You know, I mean, here's Azamra's comment on verse 10. They say, and I will multiply Adam upon you, all the house of Israel, in verse 10. Once again, in this verse, and the two verses that follow, Ezekiel, who is himself repeatedly called Ben-Adam, the son of Adam, refers to Israel as Adam. And he did it, in chapter 34, when he said, and you, my flock, are Adam. Israel have the form of Adam, the Tzelem Elohim, when they follow the Torah of Adam in Numbers chapter 19 and verse 14. Of course, that's the end of the comment from Zamra. Of course, this assumes, that assumes that this will occur when Israel Yehuda comes into the land with the purpose of following Yah and his Torah, which most of Israel is not doing today. Many are, to be sure, but probably not many more, if any more, than so-called Christian believers who do not live after Yah's heart, but more in their denominational eccentricities, including messianics. Now, verses 11 and 12 are a promise from Yah that if Israel will follow hard after his commands and precepts, they will prosper both physically and spiritually, and that prosperity will make the heathen take notice and make them want Israel's type of prosperity and also turn to Yah as their Elohim. In my not so humble opinion, this will be coming to pass during the millennium. That's in Revelation chapter 20 and 21, when Messiah will conquer and reign from his throne in Jerusalem after the satanically inspired all-out rebellion that we see in the first 18 chapters of Revelation. Now, here's Azamra's commentary on verses 13 and 14. Because they say to you, you are a land that devours men, in verse 13. This was the complaint of the 10 spies, who gave a false report about the land as a land that eats up its inhabitants, in Numbers chapter 13 and verse 32. Likewise, Israel's enemies say that the land is accustomed to destroy her inhabitants. The Amorites were consumed there, and the Jews were consumed there. And that's according to Rashi on Ezekiel 13. But God promises that the land of Israel shall not devour men anymore, nor anymore bereave your nations, in verse 14. Surely this can be taken as a promise that contrary to the hopes of Israel's enemies, there will not be another exile. Okay? And that's the end of Zamra's commentary on verses 13 and 14. And that is what makes me see this as an end-time prophecy, that there will be no further exile of Israel, Yehuda, Ephraim, from the land of promise. They will look upon him whom they have pierced and who is calling them home to him, and they will understand that they have been deceived by sincere men who had the wrong idea of Yeshua in his on earth. Now, verse 15 is Yah's promise that Israel will never allow his people to have to put up with derision and shame because of their heritage, because the people of the earth will have it on Yeshua's word that it was the adversary who had brought all this derision on Israel, because he knew the truth of their exalted position in Yah's economy and tried for millennia to usurp their rights from them. Look at the KJV's last phrase. You will never again cause your nations to falter. You is Israel, who caused their nations, plural, to falter. Each man of Yaakov is a national father. And the idea that each caused nations to falter tells me that each son of Yaakov fathered many nations. This prophecy, therefore, to my twisted tree-wallop brain, says that after the final rebellion and dissolution of Hasatan, Israel will populate the universe with sons of Yisrael. Now, think of Abraham. Can you count the stars, Abraham? So will your seed be. And remember that his seed was Yitzhak, whose seed was Yaakov Yisrael. That's what I got through verse 15, and we're getting pretty close to the break. It's about 3 minutes away.
Okay.
Yeah, let me just add, too, about 15.
Please.
Because, yeah, like MP was saying, it's stated here that that there will be no more shame of the heathen, which really has to do with the result of sin. Okay? So it looks to me like there won't be any more pointing out from Yah of sin, you know, to show the rest of the world. And neither will it bear the reproach of the people. So, you know, again, it sounds like there won't be all of this sin in the world anymore, that he is apparently going to put his spirit in them so that they do not fall. I mean, that's what he says. The nations will not fall anymore.
Amen.
So he must be lifting them up. And that's, you know, that's what he's going to do for all of us. He's supposed to lift us up, give us a heart of flesh, and take away the heart of stone, you know, which he has, you know, given us the chance for thousands of years to make our own choices to, you know, to discern through the spirit as well, but to discern between good and evil and the different paths. So apparently he's going to cause us all to walk down the right path. Can you imagine that? All I can say is hallelujah, because boy, does this world need that right now.
Oh, yes, we certainly do. All of us.
Oh, take away the wickedness.
Even those of us who are his still need all of that.
Yes, amen. Even ourselves. I mean, a lot of us.
That's right.
Think that we are totally unclean. You know, I certainly don't lift myself up. And I can only pray that he'll touch me as well. He'll touch us all, you know, and make us one big happy family someday. That's what I'm looking forward to anyway.
And that, I think, more than takes us to the break. So we'll pick it up there after the top of the hour. Stay with us. Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. All right. Welcome back, folks. Next, second hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. We're still dealing with some technical issues, but hopefully at least the podcast will sound good for the show. And we are talking about the book of the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 36. And when we went to break, we had just finished, I think, everybody's comments coming up to about verse 16. And unless I hear an objection, that means we're ready to read on, correct?
Yeah, you can go on through 19 or 20 if you'd like.
Yeah, maybe a bit.
I agree.
Moreover, it says, the word of
Yahweh. Yeah, you can even go to 23 if you want.
Oh, okay. Moreover, says, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, when the house of Israel, Beit Israel, dwelt in their own land, they defiled it by their own ways and deeds. To me, their way was like the uncleanness of a woman in her customary impurity, her time of nidah. In other words, and by the way, the reason why this is considered biblically such a nasty thing is because it's representative of death. This is a time where an egg that was able to be fertilized isn't, and it comes out, and there is literally a stigma of death associated with it. So therefore, he says, I poured out my fury on them for the blood they had shed on the land, and for their idols with which they had defiled it. Gee, does that sound familiar? So I scattered them among the nations, and they were dispersed throughout the countries. I judged them according to their ways and their deeds. When they came to the nations, wherever they went, they profaned my set apart, my kadosh, my holy name. When they said of them, these are the people of the Lord, as opposed to the people of Yahuwah, perhaps, and yet they have gone out of his land. But I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the nations and wherever they went. So let's pause there, because we're going to get to the therefore next. Go ahead. Let's see. MP, we'll go to you this time.
All right. Good deal. Okay. I'm going to open with a Zamra on the last three-fifths of the chapter. Okay. They say this about 16 through 38. 16 through 38 of this chapter, speaking of the sprinkling of the waters of purification upon Israel to purify them of their sins, make up the Haftarah read on Shabbos Parasha Parah after Purim, which is preparing for the coming festival of Pesach. The weekly Torah portion is followed by an additional Torah reading about the purification from defilement from the dead through the ashes of the red heifer in Numbers chapter 19, verses 1 to 22. Okay, so that's their comment on verses 16 to 38 here, and I'm going to move to my commentary on 16 to 19. Azamra fully understands Israel's position in Mashiach, even if they don't recognize Yeshua as Mashiach. They say this, introducing the theme that at the end of days, Israel will be purified of their sins, in verses 16 to 21, the prophet recounts the history of Israel after they first took possession of the land, when they defiled it through their way and their deeds, like the impurity of the menstruous woman, in Nedah, was their way before me, in verse 17. Because the assembly of Israel is metaphorically called God's wife, while he is her husband, when she sins, she is compared to a nidah, whose husband distances himself from her throughout the time of her period, but draws near to her after her purification. Likewise, Elohim distanced Israel and exiled them to the lands of the nations because of their sins. But he will restore them after they return to him and become purified of their sins. Again, that's Radak on verse 17. Now, isn't that cool? The time of the woman's nidah is roughly 8 to 10 days. Having never personally to experience it, I infer the time from my lovely bride's experience, which early in the marriage was somewhat difficult to endure. Now, that's 25 to 35% of the month. Depending on the month. Whatever the case, the wife must exile herself from her husband until she is clean. What we are seeing here is the cleansing of Israel from her nidah and purification to once again become intimate with her Yah. And once again, I see a striking likeness to Israel's ability to return to her Elohim and once again be intimate with her husband. And you can believe me when I say that both parties to the relationship have a hard time waiting for her cleanness. Okay? Now, Azamra, on verse 20 through 23, they say this. Israel's ignominious exile and degradation in the lands of the nations is Chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name, in verse 20. Conversely, the ingathering of Israel before the very eyes of their enemies is the sanctification of his name, for they will know that Elohim rules. That's in verse 23. Now, here's me. Verse 20 opens with Israel coming to their exile in wherever they happen to go, mostly into Chaldea or Babylon, and they actually talk down the land of promise as if they were sent into exile because they had lived totally righteously. Okay, Stone's Chumash has an interesting note on verse 20. They say, people assumed that Elohim's people were forced into exile because he lacked the power to save them. When weakness can be ascribed to Elohim, his name is desecrated. They seem to have had the audacity to blame Yah for their own misdeeds and the resulting diaspora. Israel desecrated Yah's name, basically made it common, nothing special. And Yah gave them the straight of it. They desecrated my name by their deeds, and so I sent them away until they come to their senses. That's a Mark paraphrase of what he said. Do you see how the heathen's words tell you the truth of Israel's bad attitude? In a Mark paraphrase, the people of Babylon recognized the holiness of Yah's and Israel's land, and also had the strait of Israel's diaspora. They, in other words, Israel, refused to acknowledge Yah and thought that it was their righteousness that made the land theirs. The heathen got it. Israel obviously thought that they were all that. The Chaldeans understood better than Israel why they were in exile. But when Yah heard the words of the Chaldeans, he took up Israel's cause for them, which proves that Yah, or Yeshua, is Yah in the flesh to me, because he took up Yah's cause for them. Yehuda Israel had desecrated Yah's name to the people of Chaldea in verse 21 by their desecration of his name, which Yah then took pity on. And then Yehezkel was ordered to open his mouth to Yehuda Israel in verse 22. Therefore say unto the house of Israel, thus saith Adonai Yah, I do not this for your sakes, house of Israel, but for mine own holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the heathen whither you went. Israel had profaned Yah's name wherever they'd gone, with whomever had come to visit them, and whomever they had gone to visit, in verse 22b. But, in verse 23, he gets to the point of this oracle to the children of Israel. In a Mark paraphrase, he says, I will make my name holy to the heathen, to whom I sent you to be witnesses to me. But you desecrated my name among them, to whom I had sent you as witnesses to me. When I am finished with them, they will know that Yah has been among them. End of the quote. I wonder why Israel Yehuda didn't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me why they didn't get it. They had the word directly from Yah so many times, repeated over and over and over again, and they just couldn't get it. Anyway, that's what I got through verse 22.
Okay. Let me say a little something on 16 through 19. I can't say that I recall Yah putting together the blood of a Nidah woman in her uncleanness with the blood that the wicked shed upon the land. I normally associate blood being shed upon the land likened to the event with, for example, Cain and Abel, whereas the blood came from Abel in his death. But think about the blood involved in a miscarriage or in suffering an abortion. This is how Yah saw the works of his own people. I can see no confusion in the reasoning for Yah to be full of wrath. He judged them reasonably, considering the grave sin that they had mustered in their deeds. And this is why they were scattered and dispersed, which words Yah seems to use together quite often in the various times in which Yisrael was spanked. And those two words I'm talking about is scattered and dispersed. Okay? Because, yeah, those two are very descriptive in what Yah does, meaning he does kick them out of the land, which is a dispersion, okay? He disperses them out of the land throughout the countries, and then he scatters them. He doesn't just send them to one heathen location. He throws them all over the place.
That's right.
You know? So, yeah, and there's really a good reasoning for this, too. I've heard some who study the word talk about how being scattered makes it, for example, harder to find such individuals, you know, and gather them up for death, let's say. Yeah, it makes it much harder if they're scattered all over the place. But really what I love is the wonders of how in the end of days, and we're seeing these words written here in this chapter as well, in the end of days, how he brings us back from all the different locations under the heavens where we are. And really it's this wondrous idea of being brought from every little, you know, nook and cranny of the world. It's just such an awesome and wondrous idea that he does this. You know what I mean? anyway, I think that's yet another reason why he scatters us. You know, he doesn't keep us in groups, so to speak, but just throws us all over the place. Verses 20 and 21 is a really good example in what profaning his name really is. I often hear a similar misunderstanding of the second commandment, in which folks believe saying the name incorrectly is what is so wicked. In profaning his holy or set apart name, it is very much detailed here in these verses. They're lies in that they are his people, even though they are not in the land. Okay? This is one thing that I believe really captures the idea of profaning his name. This would make Yah a liar if this were true.
That's so right.
So in this lie, it is truly belittling of his authority and his word. That's what they're doing. They're belittling his authority and word. And I'm not surprised that Yah continued to be compassionate through the sins of Israel, because he does this time and time again, even though, you know, as a father, you can imagine how upset you would be about some of the things they've done. You would truly be so upset you'd just want to throw them out to the wind, you know? but no, he loves us that much that even through the sins, he has a hard time letting go, you know? He's always compassionate, always full of forgiveness. And though he chastised them as they deserve, he always had an ear open to hear them if they finally decided to humble themselves and turn back to him.
Yeah. That's right. And though, Ken, I have said it a lot of times.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have said it a lot of times. He's looking for just the merest, okay, M-E-R-E, mere, the merest turn of heart to him. That's all he's looking for. And he will welcome you home with open arms. He's waiting for you to stop running away from him and just turn a little bit. Could be only 2 or 3 degrees. You know, turn towards him. That's all he's after.
Absolutely. I know. He is that way. And that's the way he wants us to be, by the way. We need to remember that, because we need to be that way too. We need to be forgiving.
Exactly.
But yeah, though this was always challenging and that sin seemed to abound in Israel, there always seemed to be such a remnant though too. You know, those who would not let go of his ways. And I think he did this purposely. I think he truly made sure that his heart was in them, at least in a remnant of them, so that, you know, there was always a few who would not walk away, not turn their face from him and walk a different path. Let's see. That was up to verse 21. And you know, I think that's all that MC read up to that point. So let me stop there and see if we could do a little more reading.
Sure.
MC.
Let's see. So, you say 20.
Take us through at least 23.
Well, so he has scattered them among the nations, he said, dispersed in countries. Whenever they came to the nations, wherever they went, they profaned my set apart, my holy name. When they said to them, these are the people of Yahuwah. But I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel, Beit Israel, had profaned among the nations wherever they went. And here we get to the place where we pick it up with the word therefore. So therefore, say to Beit Israel, thus says Yehu Eloheka, I did not do this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake. By the way, when I read this, I can't help but think I've had discussions of lately, anything that implies that the Torah matters is works-based salvation. Are you implying, we're saved by faith alone, not by grace? Well, you know what? He's doing this for his holy name's sake. And when people then profane his holy name and say he can't keep his word, when he says he's the same yesterday and today and tomorrow, but he isn't. He did away with his Sabbath and he did away with his, I'm thinking, you want to profane his holy name? Maybe they don't know what he's talking about here. So he says, I'm not doing this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the nations wherever you went. Maybe by saying that we've got better gods now and Ishtar Sun God Day and bunnies and eggs and Christmas trees. And I will sanctify my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in their midst, and the nations shall know, ready, Ki Ani Yehuah, says Yehuah Eloheka, when I am hallowed in you before their eyes. Now we're going to get what looks like another prophecy of the greater regathering, the greater Exodus here next. But let's pause at that point because he's going to tell us what's going to happen and what is coming. And this sounds like something we've heard before, and hopefully we'll see. MP, let's go to you at this point.
Okay, where did you stop there, Mark?
I stopped at verse 23 at the end. 23.
The end of 23. Okay. And let me start at verse 20. Verse 20 opens with Israel coming to their exile in wherever they happen to go, mostly into Chaldea and Babylon. And they actually talked down the land of promise as if they were sent into exile because they had lived totally righteously. Stone's Chumash has an interesting note on verse 20. They say people assumed that Elohim's people were forced into exile because he lacked the power to save them. When weakness can be ascribed to Elohim, his name is desecrated. Now, they seem to have had the audacity to blame Yah for their own misdeeds and the resulting diaspora. Israel desecrated Yah's name, basically made it common, nothing special, and Yah gave them the straight of it. They desecrated my name by their own deeds, and so I sent them away until they came to their senses. Until they come to their senses. That's a Mark paraphrasing that, by the way. Now, do you see how the heathen's words tell you the truth of Israel's bad attitude? Another Mark paraphrase. The people of Babylon recognized the holiness of Yah's, Israel's land, and also had the strait of Israel's diaspora. They, in other words, Israel, refused to acknowledge Yah and thought that it was their righteousness that made their land theirs. The heathen got it. Israel, obviously, they were all that. The Chaldeans understood better than Israel that they were in exile, why they were in exile. But when Yah heard the words of the Chaldeans, he took up Israel's cause for them, which proves that Yeshua is Yah in the flesh to me, because he took up Yah's cause for them. For us, okay? Yehuda, Israel, had desecrated Yah's name to the people of Chaldea in verse 21. By their desecration of his name, which Yah then took pity on. And then Yehezkel was ordered to open his mouth to Yehuda, Israel in verse 22. Therefore say unto the house of Israel, thus saith Adonai Yah, I do not this for your sakes, house of Israel, but for mine own holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the heathen, whither ye went. Israel had profaned Yah's name wherever they'd gone, with whomever had come to visit them, and whomever they had gone to visit, in verse 22. But in verse 23, he gets to the point of this oracle, to be witnesses to me, is what he said. I will make my holy name, or my name holy, to the heathen to whom I sent you to be witnesses to me. but you desecrated my name among them, to whom I had sent you as witnesses to me. When I am finished with them, they will know that Yah has been among them. Okay? Now, I wonder why Israel Yehuda didn't get it. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. He's been telling them this for hundreds, thousands, a thousand years at least, and they still ain't getting it. Anyway, that's what I got through verse 23.
Ken?
Yah repeats himself a time or two in these two verses of 22 and 23. And because their charge was the profaning of his name, I can't help but wonder how they could have given such little attention to the third commandment. Let's recall this in its words, okay? This is Shemot, or Exodus 20, verse 7, where it's written, "You do not bring the name of Yahuwah your Elohim
to not," I think is what he said,
"not leave the one unpunished who brings his name to naught." I like this 1998 version of the scriptures translation when iterating this commandment. And to commit such sin before the nations, when such a people as Yisrael were supposed to be his people, bringing his name or authority to naught, meaning to nothingness. And because they didn't sanctify his name, he must do it himself, right? That's what he's saying. I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for my namesake, so that the nations understand who I am.
Well, let's pause there just for a second,
because you're,
Ken.
That's just me.
We're almost
sure, go ahead.
We're almost at the break, and I want to pick it up in that spot when we come back. And what I'll do is I'll ask a question, and this will take us to the break. And I'd like to at least pick it up with this when we get back, if you don't mind. Bring his name to naught. That is an interesting way to put it. And I can't help but think, you know, if you read the King James Version of the Bible, most English translations, where they picked up with a rabbinic tradition, which brings his name to naught. We're going to take Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. We're going to, because you might mispronounce it, we're going to hide it completely. You're going to take it clear out of there. 7,000 times his name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, was removed and replaced with capital L-O-R-D.
That's right.
It isn't quite not, but it's about a not short of not as far as being completely expunged. So with that, we are at the break. Thanks, folks, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Do-do-do-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum, dum. Come on, come on, dum, do-be-do-dum-dum, dum. Come on, come on, dum, do-be-do-dum-dum, dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. They say that I'm bound by the Lord, the 16th.
And we are back, folks. Final segment today of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh edition. And where we went to break was a comment that I had and a question that I wanted to kick us off with. I'll go back to Ken here in just a second. But essentially, he mentioned the commandment that is pretty much ignored by the Hor Church and the Hor Synagogue, and that is, do not bring my name to naught. And I do think that's a pretty interesting way to translate it. No, folks, that is not to say the GD word, because his name is not God. At best, that's a title. It's not his real name. It's not even the real word that's used to represent that name, or the title even in the Hebrew. But what they have done, of course, is taken his tetragrammaton, that name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, as in Ki Ani Yahuwah, and removed it over 7,000 times in most, but not all, or there's at least a few of them getting it right, English Bibles. So my question is, hey, isn't that really, or at least is that another option for what it means to bring his name to naught? So, because most
yes.
Americans, most indeed Christians, don't even know his real name. A lot of them have never heard it. They might have heard Jehovah from Jehovah's Witnesses, and they don't even know that, you know, they've maybe got a little bit closer to the name. There is no J in Hebrew, of course, so that's not quite right anyway. But anyway, let's go back to Ken. Let him comment, weigh in on all of that. Go ahead.
I actually look at it differently, thanks to this translation, like I mentioned. The 1998 version of the Scriptures, which is a Bible translated by a group down in the country of South Africa. They put together a really good, you know, generalized Bible. I like the idea of saying that his name is being brought to naught, because to me, his name has to do with his authority. Okay, and that we are to do as he says. To me, that is bringing his word to naught. Okay, that would be a definition of bringing his name to naught, would be not to do what he prescribes to do. Okay. That's how I see it. Now, I know a lot would say, well, it has to do with his name, you know, it's not, maybe it is or isn't God, maybe it is or isn't Jehovah or Yahuwah or Yahweh. I mean, there's so many different names you could go with, and I mean, can anyone really claim 100% accuracy on this? I don't believe so. You know, but we're all doing the best we can. That I can appreciate. But in terms of bringing his name to naught, again, like what I said, I feel if we look at all the instances throughout Scripture, I think it really does help point out a bit that he's speaking of his authority and his word, and that when we're not, you know, when we're bringing his name to naught, we're literally walking in sin. We're not doing as he prescribes. That's
all right.
That's how I see it. Did y'all want to comment some?
If you put it that way, let me just add one quick thing, because I actually agree with that, and I think that hiding his name is not the right answer regardless. So it's not so much how you pronounce it as whether or not we even understand that there is a name that's been hidden. But when it comes to bringing his name to naught, I tend to focus on there's a group of people that will deny Matthew chapter 5, 17 through 19, and it's very first public address where Yeshua says, I have not come to do away with the Torah and the prophets. Not one yod or tittle will pass from his word, basically, the Torah and the prophets, so long as heaven and earth still exist. And, that's the key word, and until all is fulfilled. And when they then say, oh no, he's a liar and the truth is not in him, they don't say it that way. They say, he didn't really mean that. You can't trust what he says. And he really did mean to do away with the law. He nailed it to the cross. And a whole bunch of other, if you'll pardon my bluntness, crap that makes him a liar. And if that isn't bringing his name to naught, even blaspheming the Holy Spirit, honestly, I have more difficulty with any other claim on that score. Go ahead, Mark. Why don't you weigh in, too?
All right. Yeah, you're exactly right. The fact is that people profane his name regularly, and it's not a matter of not saying Yahweh or Yahuwah, or whatever form of that you'd like to go for, although Yahuwah is a lot closer than Yahweh. but you know, he used his name almost 7,500 times in the Old Testament. Okay, he used it again. I don't know how many times in the New Testament,
because they took it all out.
They got changed to the Lord. You know?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, say?
Because they took it out, exactly.
Say it again? Yeah, exactly. They took it out and they replaced it with some other form, some other word. And so that's profaning his name, okay? A lot more than just mispronouncing it, okay? So yeah, I've got a major problem with all of that. You know, I know that his name is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I'm not exactly certain how to pronounce it properly, and therefore I shorten it and I call him Yah, because that is the first syllable, okay? And
And by the way, David,
the best I can actually do to make sure that I'm getting it somewhere close. Go ahead.
I just said David. David calls him that as well, as do others.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yeah, there are a lot of places in the scripture where that's the name they use.
Well, and not
so
only that,
I think it's a good substitute for the one that we can't really be sure of how it's pronounced because there are no hollow points.
One of the things that buttresses that point is the idea of the fact that the prophets oftentimes would add one syllable or two, never all three, from his name. So you'll see Eliyahu, for example, or you will see pick a prophet, right? Yermeyahu. And you'll see a variant of the name, which often includes the word Yah. As a matter of fact, the salvation of Yah is Yahushua, or the salvation of Yah. So it's essentially
that's right.
Isaiah, if you will, sideways. Yeshe Yahu in the other direction as to who he will be. So the point with all of that is that essentially we see the name Yah a number of places. Of course, the most universal word in about 600 human languages, maybe spelled differently, but it's pronounced the same, is Hallelujah in Hebrew, praise ye Yah. All right, Ken, let's go to you. Go ahead.
That's it.
Yeah, Yah is actually Yod-Heh, which is the poetic name that we see in many places throughout Scripture.
Exactly.
Just Yod-Heh. And let me say, one way that I really like to look at his name is because I know that they never try to hide the word for Judah, okay, which is the word Yehuda.
Yep.
Right.
And they try to hide it. And interestingly enough, that word is spelled Yod-Heh Wav Dalet Hey. So you have the same as name as Yah, or Yahuwah, with a Dalet in it. So if you take Yehuda, take out the D in it, you come up with Yahuwah. So to me, that was one real nice, like, blending thing that I could say, well, yeah, if I take the Dalet out, I could say Yahuwah. That would make sense, you know?
Yeah, that'll work.
Can I finish my notes here?
Go ahead.
On verses 22-23? Do y'all mind?
Absolutely. I'm ready to go to 24 and 25, so there.
Well, I still have to hit 22 and 23, so let me get back to it, okay? Okay. And because they didn't sanctify his name, do you see in verse 23, he says, I will sanctify my great name, and then he ends the verse with, when I shall be sanctified in you before your eyes. This sanctification, by the way, is not just his great name, but him himself before their eyes, okay? Which one could still be the same, again, if you're looking at it as his authority, his word, you know? But this word sanctify is very important to him. He's using it twice here. He's beginning and ending this whole idea about his people profaning him, before the heathen. He's talking about how important it is to sanctify him and his name. Okay?
Yep.
Now, let's look at some definitions of this word sanctify, the word kadosh, which is Strong's number 86942. Listen to these. I'm just going to bring up four definitions here that I see in both the Strong's and the Brown Driver Briggs. To set apart as sacred. That one's, one that we would have guessed. To purify or free from sin. Boy, didn't Israel do it a number on it. I think is more of a reason why he's pissed off with them in terms of profaning him and his name is because of that one. And number three, render legitimate or binding. So it being, or his name, his authority being set, bound and make it legitimate. And number four, to entitle to reverence or respect. Ooh, that's a biggie. Reverence and respect him. In their sin, his people, they belittled both him and his word. And would you not agree that he would readily sanctify us if we were holy? Right? A matter of fact, you will find this in a number of places through Scripture. A matter of fact, even back in the scroll of Shemot or Exodus, when they were in, you know, coming out of Mitzrayim, out of bondage, okay, it is mentioned that he was going to sanctify them. Okay? So you know he will. He loves us that much. The funny thing is, I can't help but remember when coming up to this word sanctify, I have to include the fourth commandment now that we've addressed the third. Let me please take a quick moment to look at the third commandment. I'm going to read Shemot Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. That's that word.
Amen.
6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of Yahuwah thy Elohim. In it thou shalt do no work, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days Yahuwah made heaven and earth, and by the way, remember this, back in Bereshit, or Genesis, the sea, and all that is in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore Yahuwah blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. There's that word. Hallowed is the word for sanctify, kadosh. He kadosh it. Okay? So note that we see this same Hebrew word for sanctify, kadosh, in both verses 8 to keep it holy and verse 10 when he hallowed it. Just as he sanctified the Sabbath back in Bereshit or Genesis 2 verse 3, remember? So he desires us to do the same. Does his Christian community of today do so? I think not. By the way, here is Bereshit 2, verse 3.
They unsanctified it, if you think about it.
And Yahuwah, or Elohim, blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which Elohim created and made. So sanctify is the word kadosh in the Hebrew. Holy is the word kadosh. Hebrew, these two words are spelled identically, only man's vowel pointing may be different, okay?
Exactly.
So let's recall his Torah in terms of sanctification or holiness, okay? I'm going to just share just a few instances of the importance of sanctification and holiness. Here's Vayikra or Leviticus 11, verses 44 and 45. It's written, "For I am Yahuwah your Elohim. Ye shall therefore sanctify yourselves, and you shall be holy. For defile yourselves with any manner of creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. For I am Yahuwah that bringeth you up out of the land of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt, to be your Elohim. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." I love that. So, like, be as I am is what he's saying, right? Leviticus 19, verse 2. "Speak unto all the congregation of children of Israel, and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, Yahuwah, your Elohim, am holy." There's a second witness, third witness. Leviticus 20, verse 26. "And you shall be holy unto me, for I, Elohim, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that you should be mine." And even Kepha, or Peter, remembers as well in the New Testament. This is 1 Peter 1, verse 15. "But as he which hath called you is holy, so be you holy in all manner of conversation. Because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy." And that was Kepha, or Peter, reminding us. Okay, so don't think this is, oh, that was just for the Jews, or, oh, yeah, that was, you know, same with the Sabbath and everything else. Oh, that's just for the Jews, or that was back in that day. No. There's proof positive all over the place, even in the Brit Hadashah or New Testament.
Yep.
That we are to be, as it said in the Torah, the first five books. Anyway, so that's what I had up through verse 23. I'll go ahead and stop there.
Okay, we got about 7 minutes or so left. Go ahead, Mark, anything else?
Let's give it a shot. I'm going to go 24 to 26, and I think I'm going to be able to get through that. So has it been read yet? If it hasn't, I'll
we
jump
were
on
at
that
the
too.
Part where it says we're getting ready to talk about the greater Exodus yet to come again. So if you're not ready for that, pause, and we'll read that.
Hallelujah.
Okay.
So verse 24. And we'll no doubt pick it up here next week because this is a big topic. And he says, after he says, Ani Yahuwah, and they'll know it, and it'll happen when I am hallowed, made kadosh, set apart in you before their eyes. For I will take you from among the goyim, the nations, gather you out of all the countries, and bring you into your own land. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you. Interesting. The water of life. And you shall be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. In other words, your Torahlessness, your rebellion. I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new ruach, a new spirit within you. I will take that heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I'll put my ruach, my spirit within you, and cause you to, do away with the statutes and all the commandments? I will put my ruach within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them. Then you shall dwell in the land that I gave your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I will be your Elohim. How many times have we heard that? How many different ways have we seen this prophecy? So, yes, this one is not unique, and maybe that's because it's so important he keeps repeating it through any number of different prophets. Mark, let's go to you.
Exactly. Okay. In verses 24 and 25, here's what Azamra's comment is. Let me read this, and then I'll get to my own. And I shall take you from nations and gather you in from all the lands, and I will bring you to your land. And I will sprinkle upon you pure waters, and you shall be purified from all your impurities, and I will purify you from all your idols. Just as a person is pure water in which he immerses, and through the sprinkling of the ashes of the red heifer, so he who was defends is purified through atonement. Metzudas David on verse 25. Now the order of the promises in the quoted two verses is surely significant. The ingathering of the exiles takes place before their purification. This should give us hope that many of the ingathered Jewish inhabitants of the land are still far from the Torah. If Elohim has fulfilled his promise to bring them back physically, he will in the end surely fulfill his promise to bring them back spiritually. That's the end of Zamra's comment, and here's mine. Yah often sends his people into exile. Even those who don't be in exile, like Daniel and his buds, okay? Shadrach, Meshach, they had been faithful to Yah from their youths, and were taken to Chaldea to be witnesses to the greatness of Yah to the very king Nebuchadnezzar himself, who did over all other gods known and unknown. In the same way that Yah sanctified Daniel, he sanctified Nebuchadnezzar. For reason, Daniel would be truly faithful to Yah, while the Chaldees were truly faithful only to themselves. Nebuchadnezzar saw and understood the difference, and that saved Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and David in the burning fiery furnace, while it consumed Shema and Daniel's rivals among the Chaldees, who worked miracles by a very different spirit than Yah. 86a, and I will sprinkle upon you pure waters, verse 25. Rabbi Akiva said, happy are you, O Israel. Before whom are you purified? Who purifies you? Your father and... Yep. The same Abba B'Shamayim, who protected Daniel and Shema from the Chaldees, is the one who is promised to watch for you and protect you through whatever storms you face for him. Azamra has this on verse 26, new heart. It says, and I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit within you, and I shall remove and I'll give you a heart of flesh. The heart of stone refers to man's evil inclination. We all have one. That's me saying that. The Talmud teaches the evil inclination is called by seven names. Yah calls it evil. Moshe calls it uncircumcised. David calls it impure, asking for a pure heart. Shlomo called it an enemy. Isaiah called it a stumbling block. Ezekiel called it a stone, as in our verse 36, while Joel, called it the northern, or all the different ways that Yah reveals our wickedness to us. I have to assume that Joel was kind of like me, knowing what a heart of stone is, but often refusing to see how it works in my own life. I often find what doesn't please our Mashiach or his Abba. It truly is, but that nature was not created in our original parents. They had to earn it by disobeying Yah's lawful order, do not eat from tree. Had they eaten anything else in their general vicinity, they'd have been okay. And all HaSatan had to do was call Yah's character into question, and Chava did the deed. Of course, we in our flesh think that we are all that and a bag of chips. But in reality, we are no such thing. We aren't, in our own natural selves, anything to write home to Mom about. When we submit to Yah by his Spirit, Yah gives us the power by his Ruach HaKodesh. Here's a Zimmer's idea about that. The heart of flesh is a heart that heeds, and the spirit that is ready to receive the words of God, that the name of his chosen city of love are the same as the phrase Lev Basar, a heart of flesh, saying that his followers would always be called the Breslov Chassidim, because his pathways have the power to turn our hearts into hearts. I think that the Breslov Rebbe understood the complete inability of our natural man to live Torah and our utter dependence on Yah's Ruach to have the kind of power against that kind of power against our human spirits. If only Adam had refused HaSatan's subtlety and just done as Yah had told him. But I think he thought that Chava was lost and he would be without her. But all he had to do was not take a bite himself. Easy for me to say, right? Hindsight is usually 20/20. And that's what I got through verse 26.
Well, we will start there next time. We will read those again, because obviously
in terms
this
of
is
our salvation.
It's very important. It is yet another one of those prophecies that I think, at least, we can see has not yet been fulfilled, and ultimately will be. With that, folks, I'll say thanks, guys. Shalom, folks, and have a blessed week.